thank you so much for your interesting talk. I got actually two questions. First one, about the third tradition that I see as a sociologist that situated itself right in the middle between those two traditions you just described, the normative and the appealing to nature. So it's tradition that consider nature as constructed. So when we read Robert Park, for example, the father of the Chicago School, he says about human nature, but human nature is what we today call a culture. So it is constructed. And it serves as a point of reference. So it is constructed in the circular, reciprocal interactions between people. And this is the truth of the social world. And this is the law of the social world at the same time. So and this tradition goes through Erwin Goffman, who sees the world as a drama. So it's not in some particular place. The whole world is a drama.
Yeah.
So what will be the post-truth condition within this?
Well, see, I put those guys you've just mentioned, Park and Goffman, in the lawmaker tradition, actually, because the constructivism, I mean, the difference is that these guys are talking about it not from the kind of Plato standpoint of the ultimate rule giver, law giver, but from the standpoint of laws and rules that people and groups can apply for themselves, as it were, to themselves, and set up their own communities and so forth, okay? But it's still looking at it from the standpoint of the maker of the laws. That's the key thing, right? The key thing is whether you're looking at it from the standpoint of the person making the laws or the person receiving the laws who has no participation in their construction, right? And that's the distinction we're talking about. Now, I think what social constructivism tries to do in democratizing the lawmaking process is it tries to give us the impression that everyone is equally a constructor. Everyone is equally a lawmaker, right? And what becomes reality is whoever's in the room at the time because there's equal parties and they have to sort it out amongst themselves. I mean, sometimes the later Wittgenstein talks this way too, right? And I think that's what they add. They add a kind of democratizing element. So they don't have this Plato notion that only a few people can set the laws and everyone else has to obey, but they're still operating from the lawmaker standpoint. They just think that that everyone is in the position of being a lawmaker. And that's where somebody like Kant, I would say, in the history of philosophy, becomes a very important figure about self-legislation, right? That the kind of morality I should have is one that I would project on everyone else in some sense, that I would have everyone do. Right, that is to take oneself as an individual to be a potential lawmaker, right? And I think social constructivism really radicalizes that in a way. So it's part of the democratizing of the lawgiver perspective. That's what I would say.
But in that case, the law is the principle of cognition of the world.
That's right.
So it's not outside the world.
That's right.
It's in the world.
That's right.
And we couldn't discern between the law and the truth.
That's right. That's right. So all of that is true.
So you need to know the laws so to live in the world. So it's not about the self-control and self-imposing. It's about it's the question of existence at all.
In the history of philosophy, of course, the way people have got around this question is to bring up concepts like will and power, right? So there's a sense in which, you know, if the law is whatever the lawmaker is able to make, right, the laws only stay in effect insofar as they're being willed or insofar as there's power behind them, right? And this is why Thomas Hobbes has this kind of very absolutist conception that if you want laws in society, they have to be imposed in a very absolute way, right? So that, in a sense, the lawmaker has total control over the situation. Obviously, you know, people don't like that side of the tradition, but I think that that is very much there, right? I mean, I think where Plato is starting from is from a position where some people set the laws and other people just obey, and the lawmakers, in a sense, have a lot of discretion as long as whatever they're producing appears to be necessary, right? So in other words, the laws could change every day. The lawmaker could be changing his mind every day. But as long as the people who are supposed to be obeying the laws continue to think the laws are fixed, then there's no problem, right? So, there are certain theories about God I don't know, again, I don't want to get into theology or anything, but in the early modern period, to kind of, around the time that people like Hobbes and so forth were operating, there was a very popular conception of how God keeps the world around, right? That God has this infinite free will, and so he decides from moment to moment to keep the world a certain way. But the people on the ground, right, the created beings, they see it as constant. They see it as unchanging. They see it as fixed. They see it as the only way it is. But from God's standpoint, he's just constantly changing his mind over and over again. Right? That's the kind of world Plato was about. Yeah.
And I have another question. What if we stop thinking about the post as the kind of switching between two levels and started to thinking it as a kind of after? So it's not switching between levels, but going some way. So it's after some event. So after, what about after the truth? After truth. So condition. So for example, when it is a condition where the particular type of truth is not the most powerful, or it loses its prominence, for example. So.
Well, see, but isn't, but see, if you've got that kind of notion of post-truth, isn't that a bit like the after-truth notion sounds like a democratized version of post-truth, right? So in postmodern discussions, when that term post-truth gets used, and they do seem to think of it as an after-truth notion, they're usually imagining that people or groups have some kind of discretion to construct their own realities. That's basically what they're going after, and that to adopt that perspective is a post-truth perspective in what I'm saying too. So I'm not disagreeing with that, okay? In a sense, what I'm bringing out is more sort of the power dimension of this, and how this has in fact always been present, even in the people who we normally associate with the truth side of the Western tradition.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
We've got questions. Well, the question, there's one here and one there. And then there's one here, too.
Why hands the hands?
Yeah, the hands right here. You had your hand up, right?
Yeah, I did. Okay.
And there was this guy, and then there was this guy.
Thank you.
thank you so much. Please scroll up.
Okay. See, this is why I do this,
yes,
right?
Because your address is.
Where do you want to go?
Your address is a first truth. Yes, it is. write it down, please.
I expect lawsuits. No.
What about the connection between first truth and double thinking?
Right.
Double thinking is in one mind, and
is
in only social being. Social being. It's me. it's only social relative. Yes.
Yeah. So double think. Do you mean in George Orwell sense?
Well,
no, because that's what I thought you meant, because that's kind of interesting here.
We lived in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, yeah, that's why I ask, yeah. No, because there's an interesting distinction between double truth and double think, okay? I mean, again, I don't know if this really resonates with you. I think this is what you're getting at. Right, in Orwell's novel 1984, right, doublethink is something that happens in the individual. Right? The individual kind of knows one thing, but then they've been sort of trained to kind of think of it in the exact opposite way. Okay? So like even though they might say, "Oh, I don't know if I believe that the country is doing so well," or "I don't know if I believe the country is winning these wars and all the rest of it," nevertheless they sort of shift out of that, in fact reinterpret it so it makes it look more positive. And this is something people are actively trained to do. So it's happening in the one mind. Now, I wasn't actually talking about this, but the double truth doctrine is historically different in that it actually requires that different people believe different things. So when in 1984, if you remember in the novel, when Winston Smith is talking to Big Brother, or the representative of Big Brother at one point, and Big Brother is kind of laying down the rules of how doublethink works and why society is the way it is, because Winston Smith, right, is a guy who's kind of can't deal with the doublethink anymore. He's going nuts, and he's wondering what's happening, and he talks to Big Brother, and Big Brother's like Plato, right? This is the point, right? Big Brother's like Plato, laying it out, what's actually going on, right? And he's saying, look, there are these two truths. There is a double truth world. There is the world that we guys who run it know, and then there's the world we'd like you to realize. And we've got ways of managing this translation. And then he explains to Orwell the rules of how doublethink work. Now see, when Big Brother is operating from a double truth standpoint, because he knows there's a difference. And he's saying how the difference works. Whereas a doublethink person is someone who lives with the difference and is struggling to try to take it apart. Okay, so that's kind of where I would see the distinction there in terms of the question that was being raised. At least that's how I interpret it.
Okay, I think we have no time for other questions. And
well, this guy, there was a guy up here. No, you sure? Your name is not being taken, trust me. Yeah, do you want to say?
No, but if the time is over, the time is over.
Yeah, okay.
There should be some authority here.
Yeah, okay, okay, well done. Okay, well, thank you.
Oh, thank you very much.